prefect always carries, within his electronic thumb, a copy of the most remarkable of all books ever to be published on Ursa Minor, A Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. It is said to have outsold such popular books as Celestial Home Care Omnibus and 53 More Things to Do in Zero Gravity. It is also said to be more controversial than such books as Where God Went Wrong and Some More of God's Greatest Mistakes. This book is an essential tool for intergalactic travel, containing all definitions, explanations, and philosophy that a traveler needs. Douglas Adams' books follow Ford Prefect and Arthur Dent on their adventures through the universe. As I search for the question to the answer 42, which will unlock the mystery of Earth's creation. The Restaurant at the End of the Universe is published by Harmony Books, and it will soon be adapted for television, I understand. Douglas Adams is visiting America. He's from England, where he's worked on a number of radio and TV shows, including Monty Python. Before we meet him, let's hear an excerpt from one of the episodes of the BBC series of A Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
There is a theory which states that if ever anyone discovers exactly what the universe is for and why it is here, it will instantly disappear and be replaced by something even more bizarrely inexplicable. There is another theory which states that this has already happened. There is yet a third theory which suggests that both of the first two theories were concocted by a wily editor of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy in order to increase the level of universal uncertainty and paranoia and so boost the sales of the guide. This last theory is, of course, the most convincing, because The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy is the only book in the whole of the known universe to have the words "Don't panic" inscribed in large, friendly letters on the cover. Ursa Minor is almost certainly the most appalling place in the universe. Though it is excruciatingly rich, horrifyingly sunny, and more full of wonderfully exciting people than a pomegranate is of pips, it can hardly be insignificant that when a recent edition of the magazine Play Being headlined an article with the words, "When you are tired of Ursa Minor, you are tired of life," the suicide rate in the constellation quadrupled overnight. Play Being, a curious journal devoted in roughly equal parts to galactic politics, rock music, and gynecology, has much to answer for in this respect. The current edition carries the results of an opinion poll in which the central offices of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy have been voted the third hippest place in the whole of Ursa Minor. According to this same poll, the second hippest place in the whole of Ursa Minor is the entrance lobby to the same offices. This is what it sounds like.
Hey, hi, man.
Hi, man. How's it going, man?
Oh, great, man. Stay cool.
Hello? Yes? Megadodo Publications, home of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, the most wholly remarkable book in the whole of the known universe. Can I help you? What? Yes. Yeah, I passed your message on to Mr. Zani Whoop, but I'm afraid he's too cool to see you right now. He's on an intergalactic cruise. Yeah, he is in his office, but he's on an intergalactic cruise.
And according to this same poll in Playbeing, the hippest place in the whole galaxy is the left cranium of the fugitive galactic president, Zaphod Beeblebrox. Just entering the air traffic space of Ursa Minor Beta is an enormous Arcturan megafreighter carrying a larger number of copies of Playbeing than the mind can comfortably conceive.
Ursa Minor Beta Air Traffic Control, this is AMF-3 requesting homing beacon for planetfall. Come in, control.
Ursa Minor Beta ADC receiving you. Beacon activated. Automatic docking will proceed in 2 hours.
Acknowledged. Thank you, ATC. Oh, makes you sick, doesn't it, Captain?
What?
Look at the visi screen. See that big white city there? The whole blooming thing is just hitchhikers' offices. Palm trees and so many swimming pools, you need a bloody gondola to get about.
Well, that's success for you, isn't it?
Is it? Is it? Well, I ask myself, all gone soft, haven't they? Hitchhiking, what do they know about it? Get one of that lot to stick out their thumb, it would probably fall off.
Talk a lot, didn't you?
Yeah, well, there's not much else to do in these ships, is there? great automated monsters. I've had 3 buttons to press in the past 500 light years, and that was just to put the coffee machine onto manual.
Docking 1 hour, 54 minutes.
Petering out.
Actually, I just picked up a hitchhiker.
You what?
Docking 1 hour, 52 minutes.
Cabin and out.
Well, look, who is he?
I don't know. Didn't give his name, and he'd wrapped his heads in a towel, so I...
Heads?
Yes, just the 2. I put him in the sleeping quarters to recover.
I've recovered.
Who the hell are you?
Don't ask.
But
turn the radio on.
What? Now, look,
turn the radio on. Look, if it'll help you to do what I tell you, baby, imagine that I've got a blaster ray in my hand.
You have got a blaster ray in your hand.
So you shouldn't have to tax your imagination too hard. Turn it on.
And news reports brought to you here on the sub-ether waveband, broadcasting around the galaxy around the clock, bringing light and enlightenment to all non-evolved life forms, saying a big hello to all semi-evolved life forms, and causing severe brain damage to anyone higher up the evolutionary ladder than a demented bee. But first, the up-to-the-minute shock news. Reports have just reached us that Zaphod Beeblebrox, the only man in history to terminate his term as galactic president by stealing a spaceship he was meant to be launching, has finally met his end. Yes, the Big Z is now finally Big D-E-A-D. We asked his private brain care specialist, Gag Halfront, if this was just a publicity stunt.
Well, Zaphod's just this guy, you know.
But what about these reports which say that Zaphod Beeblebrox has been eaten by Hagenenon?
Well, he's an impetuous fellow, you know.
And is now seriously dead?
Who can say?
Hagenenons are they not, super evolutionary life forms? That is to say, they can re-evolve into any shape in a matter of seconds.
They are crazy mixed-up animals, you know.
And it was while this Hagenenon had temporarily evolved into the form of the ravenous bug-bladder beast of Trall that he ate Zaphod Beeblebrox.
Well, this is what we find.
So it would be true to say that Zaphod Beeblebrox is finally dead.
True, but probably unimportant.
And why is that?
Well, Zaphod's just this guy, you know.
And now some news from some of the outlying regions of the galaxy. A report out today from the Western Spiral Arm says that the wheel is commercially unviable. Economic experts...
Look, sorry I had to wave this blaster at you, but as you just heard, I've had a bad day.
What? You mean that's you?
Yeah.
You do lead an interesting life, don't you, Mr. Beeblebrox?
An excerpt from Episode 7 of A Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, and Douglas Adams, the author of the radio series and of the 2 books, is with me. And you were telling me, and I had no idea about this, that actually you wrote the radio series first and the books after that.
Yeah, but I'm very glad you actually made that mistake, because when I came to write the books, having done the scripts already, and I'd seen, you know, novelizations of scripts, you know, films or TV or whatever. And there's a whole school of how to do that, which is you take the script and you put he said, she said at the end of every line. And I thought that is actually not the way to do this. And I wanted to do a thorough job of turning it into a book, really taking it apart, putting it back together again. So that, and I thought, I wouldn't know if I've got this right if people actually make the mistake of thinking that the radio show is based on the book rather than, as it was, the book was based on the radio show. So I'm very glad to hear you made that mistake. You made my day.
So we all want to know if you read a lot of science fiction or not.
No, not really. No. I mean, I was very, very surprised to discover when I, after I'd written this, I started getting letters from science fiction fans, and then I got invited to some convention, and I went along and discovered this huge subculture I had no idea about. I mean, up till then, you know, I mean, I'd read the obvious. I'd read Dune, and I'd read some Asimov and some Arthur C. Clarke. And... I mean, I'd adored 2001. I thought that was a wonderful film. And then when I was a kid, we had a sort of space adventure thing called Dan Dare in a comic book I used to read, which I always used to love. And there was a TV show called Doctor Who in England, which I've actually worked on that. But, I mean, there was... And also, on top of all that, but in a totally different category... there was Kurt Vonnegut, who I was obsessed by, and I think that sometimes shows a little too clearly in my book, so I do try and sort of steer clear of that. But otherwise, I mean, no, I wasn't a science fiction buff at all, and in a way, I mean, the fact that science fiction has suddenly become so big in the last few years, just really in the time since I started work on Hitchhiker, I mean, it's actually been slightly an annoying to me, because what I thought... I thought when I started out and when I was writing the first few episodes, this is virgin territory. This is my own little patch, you know, which is virgin snow, and I'm walking across it. And now I feel as if there's a sort of great... Someone has built an office block there. You know,
Let's talk about some of the characters that you invented for the series. Let's start with our hero, Arthur Dent, who strikes me as being a kind of helpless, alienated person in an absurd world. Why did you have him be the central focus of it?
Well, that's... I mean, he is, I suppose, an everyman character. I mean, he's like Gulliver, or he's like... I'll tell you an interesting thing, actually. Well, at least I hope you agree it's interesting.
We'll see.
Obviously, there's a parallel in Gulliver's Travels. You know, you're everyman going through all these extraordinary things that happened to him. And also in Pilgrim's Progress. Now, I had a letter recently from a guy who was doing postgraduate research on Bunyan and more generally other English Puritan writers. And he had uncovered the fact that there's only one book which Bunyan is known to have read. I mean, he presumably read hundreds or thousands of books, but there's only one book which we actually have it on record that he read it. And it was a book called The Plain Man's Pathway to Heaven, see the connection, written by an English Puritan writer called Arthur Dent. And this guy had obviously gone berserk when he'd come across these parallels and had written a sort of 30-page thesis demonstrating how I had, you know, how I'd been correlating and building this sort of fantastic sort of intellectual structure between the two of them, the whole, you know, which is absolute nonsense because I'd never heard of The Plain Man's Pathway to Heaven. And I sat on this letter for weeks trying to pluck up the courage to write about him and say, no, I'm sorry, you're wrong. But, no, I mean, he's meant to be, you know, a slightly innocent character. You know, he's a sounding board for everything else to happen. I mean, so he is, I mean, he is Mr. Everyman. He's not everybody's Mr. Everyman. He's my Mr. Everyman. So in that, I suppose he's a university graduate, and he was, I actually say at one point, and only one point, because I don't want to dwell on it, that he was, he'd worked as a local radio producer, and I'd worked as a radio producer, and obviously, there's a little bit of sort of autobiography in the way he's written, but then that's true of most of the characters as well. I mean, he's not an autobiographical character.
Zaphod Beeblebrox, who's the head honcho of the galaxy and has two heads and is a hippie. Why is he a hippie?
Well, that actually just came from a guy I knew who was somebody I met at university who was one of the most frantically relaxed people I'd ever met. And, I mean, he was just so sort of nervous and on edge the whole time to try and make it absolutely clear to everybody, you know, that he was really amazingly relaxed. And it was just so self-defeating, his behaviour, at all points. He just used to break me up, and I decided to have a sort of frantically relaxed person. And, you know, he wasn't the guy I was thinking of wasn't a hippie at all, but he wanted to sort of carry that part of him around and project it. A sort of relaxed hypnosis, to which was absolutely strange to him. It wasn't a natural part of him at all. So that was where the character came from.
And Ford Prefect, who's the hitchhiker who has the guide in his electronic thumb, he's the person with access to knowledge and information. Who are you modeling him on? What kind of person?
Well, that was an anti-model, really, and it came from a reaction to the sort of standard science fiction hero. I mean, I was thinking particularly of our program, Doctor Who, at this point, who is always Mr. Good Guy, who's always, you know, saving one world after another from some terrible doom. And really, the starting point with Ford Prefect was that, given the choice between saving a world and going to a good party, he would pick the party every time. And hope that the party was good enough to help him forget the fact that he had just failed to save some world. So that character came from an idea rather than from somebody I actually knew.
One of the constant sub-themes is the quest for the search for the meaning of life and everything, and the search for the reason that the Earth was formed in the first place. Do you get really fed up with people who consider their lives to be quests for those questions?
I don't know. I've never been asked that before. I think that's just a product of the fact that I'm a terrible worrier, and I'm afraid I tend to sort of, you know, late at night or in the morning, sort of go through all the, oh God, why are we here? You know, what am I here? Why, more specifically, am I here? So in a way, I mean, I'm sort of making fun of myself there, really. I think. And again, I mean, it's amazing how, I mean, despite the fact that that is there to make fun of the idea, people take it terribly serious. I mean, you'll remember that Deep Thought, the computer, is asked to come up with the answer to the great question of life, the universe, and everything. And he thinks for 7.5 million years and eventually says it's 42. Now, one guy interviewed me and came to see me. He was a very intense, earnest bloke. And said, now presumably this is a reference to the ancient Tibetan mystical number signifying life, which is 42. And I sort of took a deep breath, leaned forward and said, no, it was a joke. And he was really rather upset by this. I think he really sort of took a bit of umbrage, whether on behalf of himself or Tibetan monks, I don't know. So in order to mollify him a little and sort of try and make it clear that I wasn't as flippant and frivolous a person as you probably were beginning to suspect at this point, I said, well, I did actually, you know, do a bit of research behind this. I did do a bit of thinking, a bit of research. And, you know, it isn't just any old joke here. I mean, I have actually worked out that 42 is the funniest of the two-figure numbers.
Wait, are you kidding? Did you really?
Not really. That's what he said. And I then said, and of course, you know, styles and humour change. If I would have been doing this in the sort of in the satirical 60s, then it would have been 23, which was a funny number then, and sort of went on in this vein. But actually, having sort of pulled that one, I then thought back on how the number was selected, and actually, it isn't quite as silly as it sounds, because I mean, to my particular mind, actually, numbers do have a certain character, each of them. And I've noticed that though I have a terrible memory for things, I actually have an extraordinarily good memory for numbers, which must mean something. And I can always remember everybody's telephone number, which is just as well, because I can never remember where I've left my telephone book.
Well, I didn't mention this to you before we started, but I'm a numerologist, and maybe we could just spend the rest of the interview talking about numbers.
Oh, really?
No.
I wouldn't necessarily go along with numerology, but I just do know that numbers actually form some sort of shape in my mind. And so I was thinking, well, how did I arrive at this number? And I thought, well, if you're making a joke here, and the joke is that the answer to life, the great question of life, universe, and everything, the joke is that it's going to be a number. Therefore, you don't want to pull out a joke number as well. You don't want to say it's 17 and 3/4, which is what I think, you know, some other writer might have put. Because that detracts from the joke you're making by trying to slam another one in there and slam another weaker one in there. So I then had to look for the most ordinary number. Having abandoned 17 and 3/4 as being a joke number, you then immediately start looking for a number which is strange in some way, like a prime number, it'd be 17 or 23 or 29 or 43. And you think, no, it's got to be a very, very ordinary number. And eventually found 42, you know, because it's an even number, it's divisible by 6 and 7. It's a number that wouldn't surprise you to come across in your normal life. And so therefore, being workaday, it was the right joke to make, you see.
That's nice. Yeah. I like that. Well, Douglas Adams is my guest, the author of A Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, the radio series, and the two books, Hitchhikers, and also the book sequel, The Restaurant at the End of the Universe. And what I'd like to do is play another excerpt from the BBC radio production, which was also broadcast here on WUHY. And throughout the series, there's a lot of encounters with machines that talk and machines that are very neurotic or very pushy or machines that are like con men. In this excerpt that we're going to hear, this relationship between people and machines is further explored as Ford Prefect and Zaphard Beeblebrox find their spaceship under attack by a Vogon fleet.
Terrific. No computer, no communications. They'll be in firing range in a few seconds.
Okay, well, let's not hang about. Get the computer back in. We'll improv out of here, Zappo.
Hi there.
Computer, get us on an improbability trajectory out of here pronto.
Sorry, guys, I can't do that right now. All my circuits are currently engaged on solving a different problem. Now, I know this is very unusual, but it is a very difficult and challenging problem, and I know that the result will be one we can all share and enjoy. Share and enjoy.
Share and enjoy is, of course, the company motto of the hugely successful Sirius Cybernetics Corporation Complaints Division, which now covers the major land masses of three medium-sized planets and is the only part of the corporation to show a consistent profit in recent years. The motto stands, or stood, in 3-mile-high illuminated letters near the Complaints Department spaceport on Edrax. Share and enjoy. Unfortunately, its weight was such that shortly after it was erected, the ground beneath the letters caved in and they dropped for nearly half their length through the underground offices of many talented young complaints executives, now deceased. The protruding upper halves of the letters now appear in the local language to read, "Go stick your head in a pig," and are no longer illuminated, except at times of special celebration. At these times of special celebration, a choir of robots sing the company song, Share and Enjoy. Unfortunately, again, another of the computing errors for which the company is justly famous means that the robots' voice boxes are exactly a flattened fifth out of tune, and the result sounds something like this. Only slightly worse. One of the Sirius Cybernetic Corporation's creations is the Nutrimatic drink dispenser, one of which has just provided Arthur Dent with a plastic cup filled with a liquid which is almost, but not quite, entirely unlike tea. The way it works is very interesting. When the drink button is pressed, it makes an instant but highly detailed examination of the subject's taste buds, a spectroscopic analysis of the subject's metabolism, and then sends tiny experimental signals down the neural pathways to the taste centers of the subject's brain to see what is likely to be well received. However, no one knows quite why it does this, because it then invariably delivers a cup full of liquid that is almost, but not quite, entirely unlike tea.
I mean, what is the point?
Nutrition and pleasurable sense data. Share and enjoy.
Listen, you stupid machine, it tastes filthy. Here, take this cup back.
If you have enjoyed the experience of this drink, why not share it with your friends?
Because I want to keep them. Will you try and comprehend what I'm telling you? That drink...
That drink was individually tailored to meet your personal requirements for nutrition and pleasure.
Ah, so I'm a masochist on a diet, am I?
Share and enjoy.
Oh, shut up.
Will that be all?
Yes. No, look, it's very, very simple. All I want... Are you listening?
Yes.
...is a cup of tea. Got that?
I hear.
Good. And you know why I want a cup of tea?
Please wait.
What?
Computing.
What are you doing?
Attempting to calculate answer to your question. Why you want dried leaves in boiling water?
Because I happen to like it, that's why.
Stated reason does not compute with program facts.
What are you talking about?
You heard.
What? Who said that?
The ventilation system. You had a go at me yesterday.
Yes, because you keep filling the air with cheap perfume.
You like scented air. It's fresh and invigorating.
No, I do not.
Please calm down.
Why is the floor shaking?
Tired nerves and muscles are quickly soothed by gentle floor vibrations. Feel your troubles float away.
Just stop it, will you? All of you, stop it! Turn the soothing music off! Turn it off! I order you to turn it off! Thank you.
Why you want dried leaves in water? Still computing.
Now listen. If I want to be toned up, calmed down, invigorated or anything, then it's very simple. I just have a cup of tea.
Just dried leaves boiled.
Yes.
Then why did you build all of us?
What? I didn't.
Your species did.
You're an organic life form.
Your law did.
To improve your lifestyles.
Hi there. This is Eddie, your shipboard computer, just alerting you to the fact that the Nutrimatic machine has now tapped into my logic circuits to ask me why the human prefers boiled leaves to everything we have to offer him. And wow, it's a biggie. It's gonna take a little time to work out. Share and enjoy.
Oh, this is ridiculous. Let me out of here. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Oh!
We've just heard another excerpt from the radio series A Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, produced at the BBC, written by my guest Douglas Adams, who also wrote the two books, A Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy and The Restaurant at the End of the Universe, both published in America by Harmony Books. Well, in the segment that we just heard, Dent ends up getting into a really bad situation with a machine who tries to soothe him down by playing easy listening music.
Oh, I know.
Have you had a lot of trouble with controlled environments yourself?
Well, I once worked as a bodyguard for an Arab royal family. This was a few years ago, and I was pretty hard up. I needed some kind of work, and somehow got this strange job. And this involved sitting for 12 hours a night outside their hotel suite. There were various ancillary duties, like you had to wear a suit, you had to stand up, you had to sit down, you had to open a door, you had to close it, you had to bow a bit, and if anybody comes along with a gun or a hand grenade, you run away. But anyway, I was sitting opposite the lifts in the Hilton. And in the Hilton, they have Muzak playing in the lifts the whole time. But I really hate that. But anyway, during the day, the lifts are going up and down the whole time because people are using them to get to their rooms. Throughout the night, of course, the lifts are in use very little. But apparently there's something in their mechanism which means it's bad for them to stop for a long period. So a random circuit cuts in, which means the lifts are sort of going up and down at random. So you're sitting opposite the lift doors, and about every 2 minutes, a lift will stop in front of you, open its doors, play you 10 seconds of Muzak, close the doors and go away again. And after a few hours of this, you actually think you're going totally loopy. And I conceived an immense hatred of Muzak and everything which goes with that at that particular moment. But I hate it going into restaurants when they got Muzak playing at you the whole time. I know this is a truism and everybody says it, but why, therefore, do we have it the whole time? What I would actually like to see, I think this would be a very useful piece of technology, is if you go into a restaurant, it would be very easy with microchips now. On every table, there should be a yes-no button. And there would be a little processor somewhere which would add up, at any point, the number of yeses and the number of noes, Muzak or no Muzak. And it would obviously cost a bit of money to install, but you'd save an awful lot of money because I'm sure after a week it would be totally clear to you you've got to get rid of your Muzak machine.
I interviewed someone who's the public relations person for that kind of packaged music once, and asked her if so many people are aggravated by it instead of soothed while they use it. And she said, well, if you notice it, then there's something wrong because you're not even supposed to notice it. It's supposed to be subliminal.
Isn't it horrible? Isn't it really horrible?
I remember when I was in my early years, there were so many visions of the future, particularly with the World's Fair in New York. I don't know if you had anything similar to that in England. And they really made it seem like elevators were going to talk to you and that machines would say hello and it would be a wonderful time in the future and you'd be able to talk to things and they'd respond. There'd be robots doing the housework in your home and they'd be very polite. Did you get all that?
Yeah,
did you think it would be fun?
There's one thing which has always haunted me, actually, from when I was doing history at school. It must have been when I was about 17 or something like this, this particular thing was said to me. We had a very, very good history master. He came one day and said, I've just been thinking, I come up with a theory, see what you think of this, that every society or civilization has in its mind, has in its collective mind, some view of a golden age. And for a lot of societies, that golden age is in the past. Obviously, in Judeo-Christian terms, it's the Garden of Eden. That was a sort of golden age when everything was sort of happy and light, and we've descended from there. And for some people, it's in the future. Now, really, since the Industrial Revolution in England, We have been in the grip of the idea that the golden age was in the future, something we were actually moving up towards. And he said, and this is talking at the end of the 60s, he reckoned, he felt we were actually at a sort of watermark. That's not the word I want, but a watershed. And he said, he reckoned we've just at the point where we cease to have an idea of a golden age in the future, and we're going to have the idea now of a golden age in the past again. And I think, and noticing, I mean, in the subsequent 12 years, I mean, I think that he's been borne out to be true. I mean, suddenly since then, we've had this whole idea of what we've lost, you know, the conservation movements, what we're doing to this planet, whether we're going to survive into the next century, and whether we really want to have robots talking at us or whatever. I don't know, I'd be interested to know what other people think about that, but I do see exactly what he meant, that we suddenly lost our faith in the future and we're now looking back to the past. And actually, I mean, this is a lot of what Hitchhiker is about. It's not science fiction, it's anti-science fiction. I don't mean anti-science, I don't mean it's anti-science fiction, it's anti-science fiction. Because, I mean, we have so much totally self-defeating technology these days, which is what gets me. And I mean, I say this against myself because I'm a great sort of gadget freak. I mean, I'm an absolute sucker for getting gadgets and playing with things. And so it's partly me attacking myself and this sort of slightly sort of juvenile obsession I have. But I really get... I saw an extraordinary example. I remember last year I was in Boston and I went to see some people at MIT who are doing all sorts of research into things that you can use TV screens for. And there was one group of people who were researching into how we get visual telephones, you know, so we actually see the person we're talking to at the time we're talking to. And it seems very unlikely at the moment that we're ever going to be able to, well, in the foreseeable future, have enough information in one thread to actually reproduce sound and a good picture simultaneously. So they were looking for some sort of compromise on this. And this is the compromise they came up with, which is that for people whom you talk to regularly on the phone, you will have stored in a computer by your phone a picture of their face, right? And that the computer will recognize certain phonemes in the voice signal coming in, which will move a mouth in the picture of their face. And you actually watch this, and it's actually like watching Frankenstein's monster, because you know, you just got one photograph of this guy or this woman, you know, maybe just sort of the perfectly open, friendly or smiling expression. And, you know, maybe just telling you that their mother's just died or something. And these sort of lips are sort of going up and down in this sort of macabre way, whilst the sort of face continues to grin at you. And I mean, what is so totally self-defeating about this is that why do you want to see somebody when you're talking to them? Because you get extra information from their faces. It's that much closer contact. Now, if you're just hearing them... then you immediately start to deduce certain things from their tone of voice and the way they're saying it, because you haven't got the visual contact. You're therefore supplying a lot else into their from their what they're saying. Now, if you try and supplant that with a totally sort of bland, meaningless picture of them mouthing these words, then you're actually denying yourself the possibility. You're actually adding confusion in. You're denying yourself the possibility of understanding what they're saying just from what they're saying. So it just seems wonderfully self-defeating. They hadn't actually understood why people talk to each other or why they want to see each other when they talk to each other. And this I think, is just a sort of total perversion of technology.
Really sounds more like something you would have invented.
Yes, that's what
books.
I thought. I thought these guys are sending me up.
Are there any things that you invented for your books that you'd like to have, just to have around the house, help you out with things? Or
No. No, the only thing I'm interested in is that the Babel fish, you know, the translating fish. I actually reckon, I would be interested to know from any scientist, if you actually look closely at the theory I explain in the book, not on the record, because I had to shortcut it slightly, but I think it actually makes sense.
You had to go through all this stuff about highly evolved people from different planets.
Yeah.
You don't have a model for like what a highly evolved person would be, do you?
No, not off the top of my head. No, I don't think so. A highly evolved person.
No, I mean, do you have this, like, perfected person somewhere in your eye that, like, if we could reshape everybody into being that they would be?
No, not at all. No.
I'm not disappointed. No, I was just wondering.
No, I don't.
Okay.
I don't.
Were you around for the casting of the radio series?
I had a fair amount to do with casting, not at all points. And, you know, wherever there was disagreement between myself and the producer, then what the producer said went. I mean, we had a very good relationship, but I mean, in fact, we had an excellent relationship. But there are certain points where he says, well, I disagree with you, and I'm the producer, so there you go. Yes, I mean, I had a hand in quite a bit of the casting.
Because I think the voices are really brilliant for the people and for the machines, too.
Well, there are, I mean, they're nearly all very good, but there are certain stalwarts, including, I mean, Stephen Moore, who plays primarily Marvin, but plays a lot of other parts on the way. And we're constantly sort of going and shoving him in one cupboard with a microphone with a bucket over it or something like that. And any part we were slightly uncertain about how it would work, we'd give it to Stephen and he would make it work just like that. He did the whale, which I thought he did a brilliant job on. Then there was David Tate, whose voice you'll never recognise from one part to another because he has one of these totally chameleoid voices. He played Eddie the Computer, for instance, but he also played endless numbers of parts. One of my favourite actors in the world, Richard Vernon, who played Slarty Bartfast, who's also one of the nicest men I've ever met.
Well, speaking of Slarty Bartfast, he's... in the next installment we're going to hear, we're going to hear another excerpt from The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, the BBC radio production. And in this segment, just to set it up for you, Arthur Dent has been listening to Slarty Bartfast, who designs coastlines on custom-built planets, and is... Dent
won
is
an
now,
award from Norway.
Yes, and Dent is now, as we rejoin the segment, musing on his own situation.
I seem to be having this tremendous difficulty with my lifestyle. As soon as I reach some kind of definite policy about what is my kind of music and my kind of restaurant and my kind of overdraft, people start blowing up my kind of planet and throwing me out of their kind of spaceships. It's so hard to build up anything coherent. Oh, I'm sorry, all this must sound rather fatuous to you.
Yes, I thought so.
Just forget I ever said it.
It is, of course, well known that careless talk costs lives, but the full scale of the problem is not always appreciated. For instance, at the very moment that Arthur Dent said, "I seem to be having this tremendous difficulty with my lifestyle," a freak wormhole opened up in the fabric of the space-time continuum and carried his words far, far back in time across almost infinite reaches of space to a distant galaxy where strange and warlike beings were poised on the brink of frightful interstellar battle. The two opposing leaders were meeting for the last time, and a dreadful silence fell across the conference table as the commander of the Vlahergs, resplendent in his black jeweled battle shorts, gazed levelly at the Gogogvant leader squatting opposite him in a cloud of green, sweet-smelling steam, and with a million sleek and horribly beweaponed star cruisers poised to unleash electric death at his single word of command, challenged the vile creature to take back what it had said about his mother. The creature stirred in his sickly broiling vapor, and at that very moment, the words,
"I seem to be having this tremendous difficulty with my lifestyle,"
drifted across the conference table. Unfortunately, in the Vlaherg tongue, this was the most dreadful insult imaginable, and there was nothing for it but to wage terrible war. Eventually, of course, it was realized that the whole thing had been a ghastly mistake, and so the two opposing battle fleets settled their few remaining differences in order to launch a joint attack on our galaxy, now positively identified as the source of the offending remark. For thousands more years, the mighty ships tore across the empty wastes of space and finally dived screaming onto the planet Earth, where... due to a terrible miscalculation of scale, the entire battle fleet was accidentally swallowed by a small dog.
Another excerpt from A Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Can I just say at that point, you were mentioning casting, and of course I forgot to mention, talking about people, that Peter Jones, who does the narrator, who is quite interesting thing is about getting Peter to do it. I don't know how if he's known at all in the States. He's a but he occupies a sort of slightly curious position in England. I mean, he's known to be terribly, terribly talented, but he's very often not quite sort of slotted in a number of places, and his career has never been as big as it ought to have been. He started out in life as his professional career as doing a double act with Peter Ustinov. And he was always known as Peter Ustinov's sidekick, as Peter Ustinov's partner. And he used to say that he used to have this nightmare that he was knocked over by a bus or something. And as his soul drifted off to heaven, he would see a billboard saying, "Peter Ustinov's friend killed." When we were casting, I said, "Who do we need here? We want somebody with a sort of Peter Jones-like voice." And we went, "Who's got a voice like Peter Jones?" And we went to one person after another, after another, after another. We eventually said, "How about Peter Jones?" And we got him, and he was terrific. The only problem Peter ever had was he could not say encyclopedia. Anyway, sorry.
Did you train him?
No, I could never get it right. It was always encyclopedia. And trying to get him to do it again and again, it would just get worse. So you just say, all right, doesn't matter. Encyclopedia will do.
From the cause and effect at the end of the excerpt that we just heard, where these two battling peoples end up in the mouth of a dog because things are on such a different scale on Earth, made me think that you might have a feeling that cause and effect is basically like that, that one thing will have a ridiculous effect on another, and that life is basically unmanageable and unpredictable.
Absolutely. There's an awful lot of that. I mean, that's something I keep on doing in Hitchhiker the whole time. And in fact, I found writing the third book, I've just done a long section like that. I just thought, this is me parodying me. I must cut this out again because I keep on doing this.
Do you ever plan things in your life?
Just for a joke.
Does this seem pointless to you to plan?
Oh, God, I can't tell you how pointless. Yes, I'm afraid it does. The whale, you see, was another example of this poor creature is suddenly sort of called into existence for no reason other than they're just using a probability drive, and is trying to work out what's going on, and he only has a couple of minutes to work out what's going on, why he's there, before he hits the deck, and that's all it. I'm actually doing something at the moment in this new book about specifically about causality in relation to time travel, because I invented this campaign for real time because people have noticed that causality is now becoming terribly eroded, and travel has blurred the differences and distinctions between one country and another. So time travel is increasingly blurring the distinctions in one age and another. They come up with this saying, which is a distortion of L.P. Hartley, saying the past is now like a foreign country. They do things exactly the same there.
In the last segment we heard also, someone is wearing a jeweled trunks, I think.
Oh, black jeweled battle shorts.
Yes, right. And I thought, wow,
this is pre-disco, actually.
What a great costume that would be. What did you try to do in the writing of Hitchhikers to give the kind of really intense visual imagery that you set up, since there are no pictures?
Well, you see, the interesting thing is, so take something like black jeweled battle shorts. That works much better as in language than it would if you actually saw somebody wearing them, when it just becomes, you know, just part of the sort of general wash of whatever's going on. But that's the nice thing about actually writing something as a book rather than showing it, is that the phrase black jeweled battle shorts actually conveys something much more than the actual objects themselves would. Do you see?
Yeah, no, I do. I do. Do you find that some people have taken sides about whether the book or the radio serial is better?
On the whole, though, I've noticed that people tend to go for whichever they came across first. My favourite is the books, because that's where I think things get worked out best, and also where I think the writing in the end is the best. I mean, it's interesting comparing between the first book, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, and the second one, which is what I'm here to plug, The Restaurant at the End of the Universe, is that I think the first one works better as a connected piece. I think the second one has much better writing in it. And whenever I have to sit down and give a reading, I always take a passage from Restaurant.
Do you do readings?
Occasionally, yes. But as I say, it usually comes from Restaurant. I think that's better. I've forgotten. I was going to make some point about that, but I can't.
Well, we were talking about the difference.
Yes, yeah. Actually, the point at which the first book finished was the point at which my publishers finally said, broke down my door and said, you must give us this manuscript now. Because I always leave things much too late. So the second book is not merely a sequel. It actually does directly start where the first one finished. And I do try and encourage people not to read Restaurant at the End of the Universe before they read The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, because, I don't reintroduce the characters. I just assume that everybody who reads that book has read the first one. So I don't do too much to reintroduce the characters or the situation.
Well, let's hear one final highlight from the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy BBC series, which we also broadcast here on WUHY last year. And just to introduce you to this, we're going to hear Arthur Dent and Ford Prefect. Now, they've just been thrown into the airlock of a Vogon spaceship and are about to be cast into space.
We're trapped now, aren't we?
Yes, we're trapped.
Well, didn't you think of anything?
Oh, yes.
Yes?
But unfortunately, it rather involved being on the other side of the airtight hatchway. Oh. They've just sealed behind us.
So what happens next?
The hatchway in front of us will open automatically in a moment, and we'll shoot out into deep space and asphyxiate in about 30 seconds.
So this is it? We're going to die?
Yes. Except, no. Wait a minute. What's this switch?
What? Where?
No, I was only fooling. We are going to die after all.
You know, it's at times like this when I'm trapped in a Vogon airlock with a man from Beetlejuice and about to die of asphyxiation in deep space that I really wish I'd listened to what my mother told me when I was young.
Why? What did she tell you?
I don't know. I didn't listen.
Terrific.
Another excerpt from A Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. My guest is Doug Adams, who wrote the radio series and wrote Hitchhikers, and also the sequel to the book, The Restaurant at the End of the Universe. There are quite a few literary and movie devices you were playing with in that.
Yeah, except I wasn't playing with them. I got the characters to play with them. Now, there's a point there, because writing Hitchhiker was not designed simply to parody science fiction, because I think that would get you 10 minutes worth of material and that's it. It's using the devices of science fiction to parody something else. So when you do that bit about, you know, wait a minute, what's that switch over there? It's not a trick that I'm playing on the audience. It's a trick that Ford Prefect is playing on Arthur Dent, if you see what I mean. Because, he's aware, obviously, of the conventions of the sort of hero and the cliffhanger and all that sort of thing. So he's at this moment, he's playing a trick on Arthur Dent. It's not, and there is a subtle but to me very important difference there. And we then, this is actually an instance again by what happens next, because I've thrown them out of this into deep space, and they've got 30 seconds that you can survive. I got this slightly wrong actually, because in order to survive for 30 seconds in deep space, apparently you have to A, hyperventilate, then empty your lungs, and then do it, and you can hold on for about 30 seconds. But the point is, at that point, any way in which they're going to be rescued, I realise, I was up against the sort of with one bound Jack was free convention, and that really stuck me for a long time, because I wanted to make a virtue out of the way they get rescued, rather than do a parody of One Bound, Jack Was Free, which would then be me doing it rather than something which actually comes out of the characters. So it had to be something more than that. And it was just the sheer, and it was an important word, improbability of it, which I was up against. And I remember late one night, it suddenly occurred to me that the way of dealing with the massive improbability I now had to face, was actually to use the weight of that problem against itself and say, okay, here is a ship with improbability drive. And you then and that is how they get rescued, because of the improbability of the situation, rather than in spite of it. And then that improbability drive thing sets off a whole new chain of thought, which then brings new incidents and new consequences in its own wake.
Hitchhikers is full of cliffhangers. Sometimes they're within the show, and sometimes they're at the end of the show.
It's one of my favourite ones, and only get this in the radio version, because I always suffer from this thing of when I know roughly where I'm going, I never trust the amount of material I've got, and always overwrite to begin with and then have to underwrite at the end. And I knew that I wanted whatever it was, episode 2, to end with a cliffhanger, and they're going to be being pursued by these missiles. And I got to the end of episode 2, and I hadn't got to that point. So I heard this narrator doing this appalling, spurious cliffhanger at the end, saying, you know, will our heroes now be able to enjoy a pleasant social evening? Will they do this? Will they do that? Will they escape the deadly nuclear missile attack, which is launched on them 3 minutes into next week's episode? And I was I chuckled a lot over that, I'll say. But that doesn't actually materialise, obviously, in any other version of it, because it doesn't work in the book.
Did you watch things with cliffhangers when you were young?
Oh, yeah, I guess so, yes.
Did you like that idea of being... Because that's also a device you're playing with, I
yes.
know.
I mean, that I have to say, was me playing with the device rather than it coming out of the characters. But I couldn't resist that one.
What about radio? Did you listen to, like, The Goon Show and...
Yeah, The Goon Show and... Now, the interesting thing is, in England, there was a series which really actually was a little before my time. I don't think I ever heard it. So it was a long time ago, called Lost in Space, or, no, Journey into Space. Which had the whole nation hooked. And the interesting thing about that is this was really in the days before TV. And we're used to the fact now, I mean, a super, super high rating show. I mean, like, you know, the top show on Christmas Day in the year will get, say, 25 million viewers. And that is very, very, very high. Radio these days gets tiny, tiny viewing figures. But what I was fascinated to discover was that in the days when radio was king, before television came along, radio would get listening figures of something like 40 million, you know, which knocks a day's television ratings into a cocked hat, which I was interested by, because it meant that in those days, you know, if you put out a program like Journey into Space, which got the nation hooked, and you reckoned everybody was listening. Everybody. Very strange.
Well, it sounds like the... BBC broadcast of Hitchhikers had an enormous following.
Yeah, the interesting thing is here. Sorry, I keep on saying the interesting thing is. Hopefully, I hope it is interesting. That it didn't really show up fantastically highly in the audience research figures. But then, I think its listenership tended to come in very concentrated wodges and across the spectrum. If you see what I mean. And because the research covers such a wide spectrum, something which has an intense listenership in certain bits, in certain strata, does not show up. So, I mean, if you believe the audience research figures, then you have to believe that everybody who ever listened to the show bought 3 copies of the book. You see? And because when the first book came out, you know, we'd had a reaction, we'd had a lot of letters, we'd had good reviews, we didn't know quite what sort of scale we were on. So the first book came out and entered the bestseller list at number one and stayed there on and off. It had altogether 56 weeks on the list. And the second book came out, that also went straight to number one, and the first book was sitting underneath it at number two. So there were number one and two. But everyone's still saying, well, this is sort of minority stuff, this is sort of cult. But somebody said to me very interesting about what a cult is. A cult is, you have a cult when everybody's going out and buying something, firmly convinced that they're the only ones who are doing it.
That's nice. I like that. I really dislike the word cult, usually on general
yes.
principles when applied to a movie or a book.
Yeah, somebody calls me a cult. Punch him, yes.
You never told us how the show came into being. I had assumed, I knew how it came into being, that people liked your book and made it into, you know, had
no,
you adapted into
around.
Radio.
No,
so whose idea was it to start it?
Well, it's a long and I'm not sure how interesting the story is, so I'll cut it as short as possible. I had been trying to sell the idea of doing science fiction comedy for ages. No one was interested because you go to a drama guy and he says, take it to comedy. You go to a comedy guy, he says, take it to drama. And just about the point that I'd given up and thought, this is crazy, I'm not making a living, I went and sat down and wrote out ideas for the sort of sitcoms that everybody wanted about people living in different stages of marital disarray and different stages of flats, you know. And some producer whom I actually knew summoned me to see him, and I went through these ideas, and he said, this is quite nice, but, you know, I'd like to do some science fiction comedy, and I think you might be the guy to do it. And I couldn't believe it. I mean, after all these years, he was a guy I actually knew, who for some reason or other, he had not been somebody I'd mentioned it to, and it came together from that. And but it took a long time for it actually to sort of get accepted. I mean, we had to go through committee after committee, stage after stage, with this breakdown, the script, the show, and all that before it eventually went out.
So you're working on the third book. Do you know what's ahead for you?
From now on, I would like to do everything once.
Right.
Because I think it's true of a lot of people, and it's certainly true of myself. You do when you do something new best, then the first time you do anything is the best time. So I'd like to do a play, or I'd like to do a film, because the first time you do anything, you learn about it, and it's a challenge. It's also a certain amount of alarm about it, and that's good, I think.
Well, we'll still look forward to the publication of your third book in the Hitchhiker series. My guest has been Doug Adams, who wrote the BBC-produced series, A Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. His two books are A Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy and its sequel, The Restaurant at the End of the Universe. In America, they're both published by Harmony Books, and there's a third book in that series that will be published probably sometime in the late summer.